Thank you very much. So I'm here to give kind of an update to the talk I gave last year, which is work that we've been working on with Martin Vandermeet and my supervisor, Niels Warburton. And so many people here are very concerned with calculating the gravitational subforce. And the question that I pose is, well, what do you do once you have it? The idea being that we don't just want to generate in-spiral trajectories, but also trajectories that are fast enough for at least a data analysis, but also accurate enough that it contains all the physics that we need. So as a proof of concept to this, we're going to look at equatorial Kerr in-spirals and that contain all first order in the mass ratio effects. So importantly, that means we don't quite have a post-adiabatic in-spiral. We are missing the very important second order effects, but there'll be a whole day about the challenges involved in that. So for now, we're just going to focus on first order effects. Great. So to kind of set some notation, let's imagine first of all that there is no self-force. We're looking at a test particle in Kerr spacetime. It's following a geodesic. And we're going to set out our parameter space by saying, first of all, we're going to pick a particular value of spin for the primary of 0.9. So that way, the two parameters that we have left are going to be the semilattice rectum, which is a measure of the average size of the orbit. You can think of it that way. And eccentricity, which is how circular or non-circular the orbit is. And these are related to the maximum and minimum radius that the particle will travel between for geodesic orbit. And you can get these as the largest roots of the radial geodesic equation here. I make this note because a lot of people have different definitions for eccentricity. So let's have that clear right from the start. And we parameterize this radial motion in particular using the radial action angle, denoted QR. Okay, so now that we have our parameter space set out, let's fill it with some gravitational self-force data, which we used Martin's code for this. And we filled it out in a very particular way to try and maximize the amount of accuracy we get for as minimum points, because that code's very slow and it takes a while to get everything done. So we're gridding from with eccentricities going from 0 to 0.5. And instead of gridding everything in terms of P, we grid in terms of Y, which is related to the semilattice rectum and the location of the separatrix, so that Y equals 1 is on the separatrix and Y equals 0 is at infinity, which I wouldn't really trust the model way out here, but it's decent enough for what we want it to be, which is in the strong field right in here. So using only, we also grid not in equally spaced in this parameter space, but also on Chebyshev nodes, I should say. So for each of these nodes, we decompose the force into Fourier series, and each of the coefficients is interpolated from a series of Chebyshev polynomials. And the end result, when you put it all together, is a force model that's accurate to less than 10 to negative 3 in terms of relative error compared to this test grid that we have, which was not used to train the data. Given that's only 105 points, it's pretty good. Of course, we could get it to be more accurate if we threw more points at it, but as a proof of concept that could potentially be expanded to the entire Emery parameter space, this seems like a strategy that could help out a lot. So we have a force model, and we're now going to get our equations of motion. And for that, we're going to use the well-known method of oscillating geodesics. So we're going to pick our orbital elements in this case to be P and E, which we've used before, the orbital phase to be Q, the action angle. And we have also extrinsic quantities, the T and phi coordinates of the particle, which aren't going to show up directly in our equations of motion, but we still need to evolve them along with everything else in order to generate our waveform at the end. And everything's going to be done with respect to Carter-Mino time. So we end up with equations that look like this. So if you look only at the first terms in all of these, you end up with effectively the geodesic equations, just recast, so that the rate of change of our orbital elements implies that these things are constants. Our phase just evolves as the fundamental Mino time frequency, and the rate of change of our T and phi coordinates are given by the geodesic equations for T and phi respectively. And then we imagine that we're smoothly evolving from one geodesic orbit to the next, to the next, to the next, due to the presence of this perturbing force here. And that gives us a correction to the orbital elements that causes these to be functions of time and no longer constants. And it causes a frequency shift to our frequency. So we have our equations of motion, we have a self-force, we can now evolve in spirals. And we picked this one in particular, we're going to use it throughout. So we have start off with highly eccentric, so 0.48 to show off what our model can do. We also pick the primary mass to be 10 to the 6 solar masses and our secondary mass to be 10 solar masses for a mass ratio of 10 to negative 5 for a typical Emery. And we pick P so that this takes approximately 1 year to go from its initial condition to the separatrix. And past that, it would become a plunging orbit and then eventually plunge. So if you go through this, you'll realize that, man, this takes so long to evolve. Like, we're talking hours. And that's just one in-spiral. We need to do thousands of these. We want to do LISA data analysis. And the reason being is we have all these tiny little oscillations that your adaptive solver has to try and resolve. And the reason why these are here is because our equations of motion depend explicitly on the orbital phases, causing them to oscillate. So sure, what we really need is just the average that goes through all of these things. But if you were to just orbit average all the turns, you'd end up losing out on the conservative effects of the gravitational self-force, which over a single orbit average out to zero, but have an effect on the long-term evolution that you need to be very careful and take into account. Now, thankfully, there is a way to do that. So both Martin and Niels use the well-known technique of near-identity averaging transformations. In the Emery context, they applied it to Schwarzschild in-spirals, and I've been tasked with extending that method to Kerr in-spirals. But while there are some minor differences, the overall idea is still very much the same. The idea is that instead of solving for your orbital elements, your phases, and your intrinsic quantities, you solve for these tilted variables instead that are related to the original variables, so an identity transformation at leading order, and then some small corrections, making them near identity transformations. And what makes them averaging transformations is that as we go and solve for the equations of motion for these tilted variables, we strategically pick these y's, x's, and z's to cancel out any oscillating terms that will appear in the equations of motion, leaving us only with equations that are independent of our orbital phases and only evolve with the slowly evolving orbital elements. And what's nice about this is that it very cleanly manages to delineate all the orders in our motion, in that you can clearly see the geodesic terms, the adiabatic terms, and then the post-adiabatic terms, which if you turn off the conservative parts of your self-force, go to zero. And so this is where you can see the effect of the conservative self-force. For full details on this very involved calculation, you can see the original paper by Niels and Martin. So when it comes to actually applying this, there's a fairly expensive offline step one has to do first. So the idea is that you take your original forcing terms in your equations of motion, you also take their derivatives with respect to P and E, and you decompose all of those functions using fast Fourier transforms at a given point in the parameter space. Right? And then you take all those modes, you recombine them to get your transformed equation terms that will be used in our transformed equations of motion. And then you do that over and over and over again. I used a particularly dense grid to make sure I had as much accuracy as possible. It's probably overkill. But then once you have all that data, you interpolate those functions using cubic splines and you just save those. So that's a one-off expensive calculation to do. But then the online steps are pretty easy. You just load them in. You set your initial conditions so that you make sure that you relate the initial conditions of your full in spiral to the ones for your knitted in spiral using the inverse knit. And then you just numerically solve your equations of motion. And so this is what you get when you do that. So I've overlapped on our original in spiral that we looked at, the knitted trajectory. And I've also gone and added the inverse knit. And what that does is essentially we take the knitted trajectory and we just add those oscillations back on just to prove that everything is in phase like what we would hope. And so if we look at the very start, we zoom in, we can see that the knit averages through all of those oscillations, and we can put the oscillations back on and show that they overlap almost exactly with what we had before. Now, doing it at the very start is, you know, easy. You'd expect it to be in phase at the start, but you can look at this anywhere in this in spiral, particularly at the end, and you'll see that it stays almost completely in phase the whole way through the in spiral. So, and this is reflected if you go and take waveforms. Now, when we calculate these waveforms, we don't have a great waveform generation scheme for this just yet. Currently, we're just taking the flat space quadrupole formula, using it really where we shouldn't. So it's not great, but we're using the same method for both in spirals and comparing those. And for a proof of concept, that's good enough. So what I've plotted here is the very first hour of the in spiral, the very last hour of the in spiral. And you can see the rapid change in the behavior in both of these waveforms, but also, again, it looks like we just have two overlapping curves, and that's reflected if you calculate the mismatch of this waveform over the entire year. It stays less than 10 to negative 7, which is negligibly small. these are, you know, for all intents and purposes, the same end spiral. So it's not only accurate, but it's also significantly faster. Now, fast, of course, is a relative term. All of these end spirals will, if you're using the knitted equations motion, take about 15 seconds. Now, bear in mind, we're doing all this in Wolfram Mathematica, which is great, but it's not the fastest thing in the world. We could definitely speed this up by moving to C or doing some other things that could help optimize this code a little bit. But the important thing is that it's faster than using the full oscillating geodesic equations. And in particular, it's faster, the smaller, relatively faster, the smaller the mass ratio is. And that's because if you have started with a relatively large mass ratio, it takes one set of time. And if you decrease the mass ratio by a factor of 10, it takes 10 times as long, has to resolve 10 times as many cycles to evolve and plunge. And so the result is that the knit is roughly, but the speed up you get from the knit is inversely proportional to the mass ratio. So the smaller the mass ratio, the better the knit is in comparison to the full equations of motion. Great, so now we have something that is both fast and accurate. So we can use this to look at some of the physics behind what's going on here. So if we look at, say, for instance, the difference in the orbital phases, either the azimuthal phase or the radial phase, which I've denoted with var phi, and we try and find the difference between these two things, we have to make sure that when we are trying to compare adiabatic end spirals and end spirals with conservative forces, that we are matching up the right things. So if we were to expand the difference between these two things with a Taylor expansion around t equals zero, you would see that zeroth order, we have the difference in the initial conditions plus the difference in the Bohr linguist frequencies times t plus corrections of t squared. So if you were to just match up the same P and E, right? Well, this is a thing that isn't gauge invariant, and you'll be dominated by an error that'll grow linearly with t, which we can see on that blue curve. Whereas if we instead match up the gauge invariant thing, right, you cancel those out, you end up with the growth in your error being quadratic in t, which sounds worse, but actually you can see from the curve here, it's significantly better throughout the vast majority of the end spiral. And that's reflected if you go and calculate waveform mismatches, that if you match up just P and E, immediately it's almost not good enough for what we need, with this line being the mismatch that you'd get from the minimum mismatch needed to calculate 90% of end spirals, or to find 90% of your end spirals. Whereas if you match up the frequencies, it actually does pretty well, at least for a few months. So adiabatic waveforms do in fact have a role to play when it comes to data analysis. But of course, the best thing would be using the knit, which stays incredibly accurate throughout the entire end spiral. Okay, so I'll just wrap up by mentioning that we've done some other work that we just didn't quite manage to finish in time, comparing end spirals calculated in different gauges and some spherical things, with the goal of all of this to extend it to generic orbits and tackle the issue of transient resonances. But I'll just leave it there, and thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. We have time for a quick question.
Okay,
so I guess that Jonathan raised his hand first.
Hey Phil, great talk. Nice to see this work coming along. Just a quick question about the mismatches. What PSD were you guys using?
Is that the, when you say PSD, do you mean the noise
power spectral curve? Density. Yeah, the noise curve.
Noise curve. So yeah, we're using a flat noise curve when calculating the overlap.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. So it doesn't have like at least a data response or anything like that in there.
Okay. Zachary, you have a question, please.
Yeah, great Phil talk. Great talk, Phil. Still early for me. Quick question. So I know you looked a little, or you kind of just assumed a certain, satisfied with certain conservative error in the gravitational self-force calculations. Did you check at all kind of like how different errors in your interpolated gravitational self-force results translated to errors in the like trajectories? Like how accurate do we need to know gravitational self-force results to get accurate knit in spirals?
Yeah, that's actually a good question. That's not something that I've looked at, but it would be an interesting thing to maybe look at. I know this sort of work has been done by Tommy and Niels in the past when looking at Schwarzschild end spirals, when they were looking at making their own model there. So we do have an idea of what to expect if you look at their paper on highly eccentric in spirals. I'd imagine we'd see something similar here, but yeah, that could definitely be a thing that I look at in the future to help round out this project, because it's still work in progress. So I'll definitely look at that.